This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I am Jamie Jackson. Our subject for this episode is the First and Second Intifada in Palestine. The word Intifada in Arabic means a shaking off. The First Intifada began in December of 1987, 35 years ago, and lasted more than 5 years, ending in 1993 when its momentum was undercut by the Oslo negotiations. Massive grassroots organizing then distinguished it from the many previous attempts to shake off the Zionist domination. The Second Intifada broke out in 2000. The story of the Intifadas has not yet ended. The collective memories of participants are accessible in numerous creations. For example, interviews by Al Jazeera with Palestinian men who had witnessed and organized the First Intifada can be viewed on its video available on YouTube. The documentary Nayla and the Uprising testifies to the central role played by Palestinian women, even in a patriarchal society. Collective memory is located in the individual. The individual gives voice to the collective memory. In this episode, we talk with Dr. Imad Musa, Palestinian-British writer and researcher who specializes in the political psychology of conflict and intergroup dynamics, focusing especially on Israel-Palestine. He also has a background in human rights and journalism. Now living in London, he experienced the First Intifada as a 7-year-old child living in a Gaza refugee camp. He was also living in Gaza during the Second Intifada. Linking the present to the past, his reflections remind us that this story has not yet ended, that it lives in the memories of those who participated or who were touched by the events, that it continues to shape the many meanings of the past for those who write or think or speak about them in the present. Dr. Imad Musa, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Okay, thank you for hosting me.
So I'd like to begin with the story of Rayan Suleiman. Could you share that with our listeners?
Oh, well, basically, that was last month. He's a 7-year-old kid from Bethlehem, and on the way back from school with his brother, I think they got involved in throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers. It's kind of routine for kids. They use it as entertainment sometimes. And the soldiers, they chased them, and I think they harassed them first. And a bunch of the patrol, a group of the soldiers within the patrol, they chased them all the way to their homes. So the kids managed to escape and hide inside their home. Only a few, like within an hour, Ryan was actually, his heart stopped and died. Well, doctors say that's because of fear. And he was so frightened that he could not take it anymore, that his heart just ceased. The Israelis say, no, we did not. We just talked politely to their family and ask him, please don't let your kid throw rocks at us, but that's okay. You can chase 7-year-old, but a bunch of big soldiers, you can chase 7-year-old, that's okay. Under normal circumstances, if the death did not happen, nobody would have taken notice of that. But because his heart stopped and he died, basically was chased to death. That's became a big story. But everything in between is basically routine for all kids who live under occupation.
So how did you first hear the story, and what were your emotions when you heard this story? What are your emotions now as you're recalling it?
It's hard to actually pinpoint what you feel, because this is really, I mean, there are a lot of schools of psychology there that discuss like post-traumatic stress disorder and all that. But in the Palestinian context, there is something unique about the experience, that we need some kind of different psychological approach to what's happening. I mean, it is not really common or known in psychology that there are many children who died basically chased to death. I mean, how often do you die from fear? I mean, there is a lot of schools of thought that is like, can you die from fear? No, you cannot. But others say, well, actually, you can. And because your lungs get compressed and you lose air and oxygen, the heart stops. Biologically, it's possible. Psychologically, they say it may not possible, but actually happened. So what you feel about that is that it's just typical. you wonder, for how long can we live like this? We're traumatized children, became parents, then given birth to traumatized children who will become parents. And it's like a kind of a vicious cycle of trauma going on almost forever. We don't see a way out of that. It's not because we bring it upon ourselves. It's just there. You're born into this skewed, distorted reality, which is ironically, to some extent, you think it's normal as children. But when you grow up, you start to see actually it is not. Either if you leave the country at an early age and you think, okay, now I have a frame of reference I can compare. This is not normal. I lived through, this is not normal. At least for me and my peers during the First Intifada, we thought it was normal. We chased the Israelis, we thought it was just a game. Then we see them actually shooting children. Then the other thing is, when you grow up and you still, you develop this kind of broader perspective, you know, with the internet on the world is open face, and you see other parallels that you can actually compare. Then you start to realize even more that what kind of life have we lived through? It's actually amazing we actually survived. We managed to wade through all this distorted reality and actually reach maturity. I would say what 90% of Palestinians, they have mental health problems to a certain degree, at least post-traumatic stress and all that.
So you have your own childhood traumas to tell us about.
Yes, I mean, like I said, for Ran Suleiman, is what's different that's not very orthodox is the death from fear. But everything in between, the chasing, the trauma, everything is just experienced by most children living under the occupation. I mean, for me, I grew up in Gaza in a refugee camp. We moved out of the refugee camp. Actually, we were forced out of the refugee camp because the Israelis actually confiscated our house. And apparently, they gave my family and a different piece of land in a neighborhood called Sheikh Radwan now in Gaza, in northern Gaza. And then they wanted to destroy our house in the refugee camp, so they will make a big street. The plan all along was actually to eliminate any signs of refugeehood there, you know, because this is stigma for Israel and will always be. But most of our trauma happened in the refugee camp, mostly during school time. I mean, I remember one of the most like painful memories for me and my friends at that is going leaving school. Then there was a small sewage canal that was near the road in the Shat refugee camp, and there was a young boy who was shot in the neck, and a bunch of Israeli soldiers surrounded around him. One of them sitting on his chest with his knee on his chest, and he was bleeding. And you can see. All I remember is like a trail of blood going into the sewage. And
You
he
are
was,
witnessing this.
yes, we could, they would not let anybody come near, which threatening to shoot anybody would come near, including the ambulance and paramedics. Well, he was basically drained dry until he died. And for kids, I mean, we would not think, we did not think of it as a trauma at the time, but we were actually angry. I think I was 11 then. And by the way, I was 11 or 10. That was 6 months after I was shot in my arm. And but it wasn't pointed at me. Actually, went to throw the guy ahead of me and hit me in the arm, the bullet. So there's a lot of festering anger in there, even for children. You don't recognize it as anger, but you think of it as a natural reaction. But after the soldiers left and left a dead body behind them, people carried the dead body and took him to his family, then to the mosque, and hell opened loose after that. People attacked Israelis, jeeps and vehicles. A lot of clashes happened because we witnessed it as children. We were on the front line of the clashes, along with the young adults. Of course, parents would come looking for kids, dragging them as like at least just watch from a distance. But at that particular time, because it was one of our neighbors, everybody was very angry to the extent that my parents, my dad, and my uncles, who were very against me throwing rocks at the Israelis, were actually participating throwing rocks at the Israelis because it felt very close to home. They attacked one of us. It's no longer about actually attacking the Palestinians, but basically you killed one of our neighbors, somebody we know personally. But it's like that all the time. I mean, at school, they would barge into school sometimes, the Jeep. When they're polite, they would come talk to the headmasters, like, don't let the kids throw rocks at us. But the principal, the head teacher would say, what can I do? I can't stop them. I mean, it's basically what they're doing now, like in Qatar. And oh, they hate us. Why are they attacking us? Why are they aggressive to us? Not a single question of what did we do to deserve this? They don't even have this level of self-reflection. But it's like you need to stop it because you're a terrorist. It's always the lack of causality in their concept. It's like always a starting for a story from the middle or the end, but without looking at what causes those people to be angry, what causes them to be very frustrated and want to just have revenge. Which is a funny part because they want you to take it. You're not allowed to react as a human. You're not allowed to be kind of,
Human.
yeah. You're not allowed to have more natural emotions because if you do, you're a terrorist.
So I'm educating myself about all the ways in which, the century-long protest against the Jews taking over Palestine. And I was surprised that, it began beginning of the 20th century. But the Intifada, the way I understand it, was a little different because it was so organized.
The beginning of the Intifada was somewhat blurred to me. I was maybe 6 or 7, but in the middle of it, I was aware enough to actually be part of it. Israeli soldiers there, clashes, different place, home incursions every other day, shooting, like tear gas, all that. It was a daily living. But people look at back at the first Intifada with nostalgia now. Compared with the second one, which was mostly armed one, a lot of people think of it as some kind of purity of revolutionary purity in a way. But I think this is something somewhat romanticized because not all of it was actually that perfect and organized. I think there were a lot of mistakes, like in the Second Intifada, like the whole revolutionary history of Palestine. A lot of mistakes, a lot of mishaps, frustrations, a lot of Israeli successes. But overall, because it took Israel by a massive surprise, because shortly before then, Israel already left Lebanon, like 4 or 5 years before then, 1982, and they kicked the PLO from Lebanon. And they thought, okay, we basically crippled the Palestinian leadership abroad. So there's no hope for Palestinians inside to actually organize themselves and do anything against Israel. Then, out of the blue, they just everything erupted, and they actually underestimated the level of oppression that was happening there, and also underestimated how far people were going to go to actually stand up to the occupation.
I think they underestimated the extent to which Palestinians were capable of pushing back.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's also there is a racist element in there. To some extent, they didn't see us as capable of actually having like national consciousness. The same as how all started with Zionism. I mean, when they came to Palestine, even when they admitted that the land is inhabited by native population, they decided no, they don't have any national consciousness, so they're not as equal humans as we are, European Jews or Zionists, basically. But they were shocked by the fact that actually Palestinians, to some extent, were organized. They have like deeply rooted cultural, political, and nationalist feelings in that land. You know, there was an Israeli, I mean, the most apologist of them, Israeli Zionists, they would say, well, Zionism came to Palestine instead of creating a Jewish nationalism, also created Palestinian nationalism. So they're attributing Palestinian nationalist consciousness to Jewish presence in Palestine. To some extent, this is true because what we call, and this is what we look at in political psychology as the in-group, out-group mentality. If you have an external threat, you tend to unite and fight against it internally. Zionism did not create Palestinian nationalism, it actually incited it, it ignited it. It was there all along. I mean, anybody who would whose country would be invaded by somebody, they would actually call in or call out all the nationalist and feelings and homeland loving and all these kind of abstract meanings, especially if we think of it at that time. Palestinians thought of Zionism as an existential threat, and it turns out to be, it is, it was, and will continue to be an existential threat to Palestinians.
You are listening to Dr. Imad Musa as he recalls his experiences in Gaza during the first and second intifadas.
So during the first intifada, you were a fairly young child. I am supposing that your experience of it was mostly being confronted by soldiers at your family home, on the street. What was that like as a young child to be aware that something was different?
When we actually chased the soldiers or threw rocks at them, we were kind of fearless. To the extent some of us would actually climb on top of the Israeli vehicles, kids as young as 10, they were very determined and fearless. But once caught, it was a terrifying, absolutely terrifying experience. Imagine yourself as a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, a child, you know how, like 150 centimeters tall, with surrounded by 6 or 7 heavily armed big soldiers with guns. I mean, I remember when we caught me, you chased me, my brother and I, we were throwing rocks and in the middle of a curfew. And we were like feeling very courageous and brave about it. But suddenly we did not expect that the soldiers actually would step out of the vehicle and chase us all the way to the sea. They caught my brother, who, quote unquote, he actually peed himself. He was so terrified. He's 1 year younger than me. I was a bit faster. They chased me all the way to the road that splits the refugee camp from the Mediterranean Sea. And they got, because I didn't know where to go. So I just gave up, and he beat the crap out of me. I was trying to hide behind his own gun. But the funny part is, once that happened, during the second, the first intifada, there was some kind of very closely knitted social network that women would actually take the role of actually trying to snatch the young boys from the soldiers' hands, because the soldiers did not, most of them did not know what to do with women, because I think they had already orders, do not attack women because they will enrage Palestinians tenfold. And, you know, it's a society of honor, and it's a patriarchal society defined by honor and determination and all that. So if you attack our women, it's a big deal.
In all societies, you know, women get a little bit more space, I think, from the violence.
Yeah. So those women basically, I mean, overwhelmed the soldiers. Each one of them was screaming, "This is my son, this is my son, this is my son, this is my son." Until the only woman who wasn't there was my mother. And she didn't have a clue what was going on. What's funny part is that because parents whose children were caught were charged with a lot of money to release them, I was so terrified of my dad, but not as much of the soldiers. Because my dad told me, do not engage the soldiers, do not go there, do not do this. But you could not help yourself. They were everywhere. They were harassing you everywhere. As a child, you acted not based on incitement, but based on instinct. So yes, it's kind of, it was kind of messy in a way. And you think about it at that time as a child's play, but thinking back, it's actually a miracle actually made it through.
So when the second intifada began in around 2000, by this time you're a young man, so that was a different experience, I'm sure, for you. Or was it very similar?
It is a different experience for two main reasons. First, awareness. Second is the mechanism of how that happened. The awareness, I'm aware of what's happened. I've got a higher sense of responsibility. I don't want to just go there and do things. I need to think things through before I make any step. Not because I'm scared, but because of I need to be careful with the consequences. The second thing, the intifada was an armed one, and the methods Israel used were warlike methods, like Apache helicopter, F-16, jet fighters, a tank, artillery, everything against Palestinians there. Not to mention, that was after Oslo, and within the cities in the Gaza Strip, there were not many Israelis. There were not soldiers. They had like settlements like Netzarim, that was in the middle of Gaza, and there was like Gush Katif in the north and the south, you know, between Rafah and Khan Yunis, and use them actually to cut off the small strip into three sections. If I want to compare, the first Intifada was more spontaneous. There was more maneuverability in terms of revolutionary purity, if you say so. The second one was extremely brutal and forgiving. And above all else, it was stifling. Complete. They would use like kind of checkpoints and to actually stifle you physically. You wouldn't be able to go from the south to the north of Gaza. I remember once I came back from Rafah, which is basically on a bicycle, you can cross this in 1.5 hour. And there was a checkpoint, a very notorious one in the middle of the Gaza Strip. It's called Abu Holi. It's near Khan Yunis, which more or less that splits the Gaza Strip into two halves, north and south. And one soldier was sitting there, decided, okay, I'm not going to let anybody go. We ended up there for 18 hours on one side. People sleeping on the mud, just waiting just to go there. Some of them can actually see their homes on the other side of the checkpoint. But the soldier was sitting there, actually waving to the cars with his feet from behind big concrete blocks. As when they opened it, it was like one entrance here and another entrance on the other side. And there's a small road in the middle. So when they open it, they actually lock you in for a little bit, for like four cars at a time. And sometimes they inspect you and everything. I mean, most annoying of all, the settlers were like whizzing by. Apartheid always in the making. But when it was my turn, because we're a bunch of young guys in one car, a tank came and stopped us. The soldiers, without actually talking to us or asking us anything, they just dragged us out of the car. And they say, give me your ID card. And I was thinking, this is just stupid. Why are you asking me my ID card? You're the one who blocked me. You're the one in my country. And basically, this comment landed me 2 days in a room I've never seen, hadn't seen the light. And then you just let me go. Believe it or not, they let me go in the middle of the night in an open area where a lot of resistance men hiding. So if I were unlucky, they would have thought, this is an Israeli coming to us. They would have opened fire at me. So they were playing games. They're just psychopathic games. I was, I don't know, 19 then or 20 or something like that. So I was not that kind of sophisticated in the sense of understanding the intricacy of what's happening. But it was abuse all along. So what started as supposed to be 1 hour trip ended up 3 days trip for me. And that happened so many times for so many people, almost routinely every day during the Second Intifada.
Well, it sounds like during the Second Intifada that the Israelis were more strategic in how to combat the Intifada.
I think they were warlike strategic. They did not deal with the Intifada as a populist rebellion. They dealt with it as a warfare. I mean, there hasn't been in a single case in history, mark my words, not even in Algeria during the independence war, that an occupier would wage a full-blown war on the occupied. There's oppression, there's suppression, there is a lot of aggression, but not deal with the occupied who are far less qualified militarily as you are, use military warlike tactics against them. It was for Palestinians, you know, this is an Israeli doctrine, we're like kind of disproportionate. Yeah, I mean, suppress them with fear, kind of hit them and hit them hard. But obviously, it doesn't work with Palestinians. We're very used to it, but we paid a lot.
Well, I ran onto a term called pessoptimist, which is a combination of pessimist okay. and optimist. So I'm going to throw that at you. How do you see the future?
Well, as a Palestinian, you're always pessimist in the sense of you don't see a way out, but try your best. You literally, I'm not exaggerating when I say we basically feel like we're being strangled every day. You know, when you push somebody into the corner and you describe, like push a cat into the corner, see what happens. The most peaceful, loving cat will turn into like a predatory animal. And that same applies to humans, and Palestinians were not from Mars anyway. We react the same way emotionally and impulsively like everybody else. But yes, the Palestinians, they have this tendency because of long history of oppression, of being very cautious about what to think of the future, because you have very little control of what's going to happen next. We have the saying that whenever we talk about about the future, we say when the donkey goes up the minaret, which basically says it's impossible. It's kind of a satirical but dark comedy that we do not know what's going to happen next, not because we're up to pessimistic, because we don't have much control of the future. And there's even like a quick thing. There's a the first attempts at Palestinian sci-fi. There's a story called like "Singing to the Birds." I think a short story talks about somebody who basically he dies and he comes to his sister in her dreams and tells her that and she tells him that his Palestine was liberated. Everybody's happy now, only to discover later that all this future was made up was simply algorithm designed by Israel to trick Palestinians into thinking that they were liberated finally. So this is the updated level of pessimism that they want to actually program our future. They want to trick us into actually a certain reality only designed based on what they want. So yes, bad experience will always be cautious about what to think of the future, but at the same time, they wouldn't survive without hope. Without hope, the heart would break,
True.
otherwise we could not continue.
So you're a British citizen now, and so does that in any way change your ability to go back to Palestine?
I managed to go back to Gaza for the first time in 15 years last year. But even with British citizenship, I cannot go, say, to the West Bank without permission, because recently I had an invite from an institution there just to deliver a talk, and Israelis actually declined my visa. You need to stop for a minute there. Israelis declined me a visa to enter my homeland. I mean, let that sink in.
Thank you very much for joining with me. Thank you for sharing your time today.
At the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, the testimony by Nombulelo Makhubu served as a forceful reminder that the individual gives voice to the collective memory. In a photo that became an iconic representation of the brutality suffered during the 1976 uprising in Soweto, her son is seen carrying the body of a young schoolboy, an image that became so powerful in its symbolic weight that it threatened to eclipse the stories of those it represented, the children who stood at the epicenter of that historical moment. During Palestine's first Intifada, some 300 children were killed by Israeli forces. During the second Intifada, more than 1,300 children were killed. More than 40 Palestinian children have been killed in the last 11 months. This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. Thank you for listening.